This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we have one sponsor for the show, and that's our good friends at Jamf Software, makers of the Casper Suite, or Jamf Pro, as it's called now, for the Mac, iPad, iPhone, and Apple TV suite. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. Hey, Bradley, how was your trip?
It was great. And so listeners didn't know because I'm kind of weird about things like that, but I just got back from a six-day trip to Belize. It was very, very nice.
You don't want to compromise your operational security there.
True. We were originally supposed to go to St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and that obviously didn't happen because of the hurricane. And so we ended up going to Belize with some friends. My wife and I were celebrating our 10th anniversary, so we had a good time. Belize is just a wonderful place. The only thing I didn't like about it is, like, so you flew from Atlanta to Belize City, and then we were actually staying in a place called Placencia, but there's no major airport in Placencia, so you either take a three-hour car ride, or you take what's called as a hopper flight. And for example, in Chattanooga, we have an airport, and we joke these are like prop jobs, like planes. But those things are like Boeing 747s compared to these planes. These are one pilot, no co-pilot. So this guy has a heart attack, you're dead. I mean, you are just dead. And like my wife on the way back, like, rode in the co-pilot seat. Just 30 minutes of just, for me, just like agonizing terror. I was just hated it every bit of it.
Yeah, that'll do it. Yeah, I've never flown in anything quite that small, but they fly things like that to the Scottish Islands. One time I flew in something that had, you know, like a bus where there's four seats across the back. Yeah, it was like that on the plane. There's four seats across the back of the plane. Yeah, terrifying. Yeah,
this thing will hold 10 people, and I was so happy to land. And it's funny because the security at this airport is really tricky, as you can imagine. They don't even ask you a single question about anything in your baggage at all. I mean, it's that small of an airport.
Choose your plane, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the tickets are like reusable tickets. I mean, and it's like you saw me check in. I mean, why do you need a ticket? I mean, yeah. So okay. We had a good time. Good to be back to fast internet, though. It's like I'm always like fearful about uploading photos and stuff. I just want to get them all uploaded. And it's cool because T-Mobile has unlimited international. And so it's a slow. Like I have the 256K plan, so it's slow. And then the internet down there, even the Wi-Fi was a little spotty. But I would just let my phone upload to iCloud overnight and it used to get everything backed up. But I'll tell you, like, the big hit of the trip was iCloud photo sharing. That worked really well. We had like a shared album with everybody in the group. And that was really, really nice. The only downside is I know the pictures that people share, when you save them to your library, like, they're downscaled a little bit. I don't really understand the technical reason for that, but but it works. It's fine. People were able to save what they wanted, and I was able to build, like, you know, a personal album for myself of all the best photos. But on that same note, like, I was tinkering around with, I mean, I'm always messing with my photo workflow, and just recently switched over to iCloud full time. There's an article on the Suite Setup about that. About, like, at this point, I would say unless you need access on non-Mac and iOS devices, or you want a unified library with, like, a spouse, then iCloud is really the best solution. Just honestly, it's just so easy, and the wealth of third-party apps for editing and things like that. I resisted for many years, but I'm finally, like, all in on iCloud Photos. And another thing is the 2 terabyte plan for $10 a month. That is really just an amazing deal. I mean, that's better than anybody else at that price point.
Yeah, no, that's totally the way to go, and I've kind of started moving all my family onto iTunes family sharing, or whatever it's called. My daughter's discovered that she can download all my rubbish music from years ago, so I'm being mocked mercilessly for my musical choices as well, so that's something to be aware of. But
You can do you can do your family sharing, which I think is up to 6 people, and it's, you can share 2 terabytes for $10 a month, and then Apple Music Family Plan is $15 a month, and that gives up to 6 people at a time as well. And it's honestly, that's for $25, that's a really incredible value. And I feel like that gives us a lot of room to grow, like, long term. Like, I mean, we're sitting at a pretty large library, and I would say we're probably through the, how do I say, it's like the heaviest years of our life with photos. Not that we're not going to take a ton of pictures with our kids growing older, but I think most people tend to take more, like, as their babies, you know, we did anyway. So, like, as my kids have gotten older, like, we're taking fewer and fewer because they're not doing as, like, you know, you're not going through, like, the first steps and, like, them about, you know, talking for the first time. And so we're just, like, overall taking less. Now the quality is going up, but there's also, like, I think in some ways, I wonder like if we're reaching a pinnacle of size of media as well, because compression keeps getting better, and then like how much, like at some point the quality is better than the human eye can see.
Yeah, I mean the megapixel count isn't going up that quickly anymore. I mean in the sort of the 2000s, you know, you were going from a 3-megapixel camera to a 4, 5, 6. Every year you were putting on a megapixel or two, and you know we've been at 12 megapixels for a few years now, and we're not at 20 megapixel phone cameras, you know, and that's where the majority of your photographs are coming from. You know, maybe you'll pull out your DSLR, but I think a lot of the load has moved from your DSLR. You know, in when April was born, right? Every picture I took for her was, you know, a raw picture from a DSLR, so it's a big file, you know, and large megapixel count. Now the megapixel count is higher now, but like you said, the compression, the we're not shooting raw anymore. We're shooting HEIF now on iOS 11, and the compression there is much, much better. So admittedly, though, we are certainly doing much more video than we used to do before. So maybe it balances it a little bit. But I've noticed, you know, in my years of digital photography, the mid 2000s were the big bulk of data, and my data load is not growing as quickly anymore, partly for the reason you said, but also partly because everything I've done is now on smartphone, and we're hitting a sort of 12 megapixel ceiling, and we're not really pushing that hard beyond that. There's not really a requirement to do that right now, so we're definitely taking a lot of pictures, but it's the data's not going up as quickly as it used to.
Yeah, and so but I'll tell you, one of the aspects I was tinkering around with over the weekend was with Google Photos. And I'm still using Google Photos as like a backup of a backup of a backup. So basically, like, I periodically will open the backup and sync app from Google on my laptop and let it grab everything and upload it to my Google Photos library. Just, again, I'm backing up to 2 Time Machine drives, have a clone, I back up to Backblaze, then also just iCloud in general. And then, I do have them all on my laptop downloaded locally. I keep a local option on my laptop. But I feel like that Google is just like a, you know, another backup of a backup. But it's pretty cool because in Google Photos, you can actually share your entire library with somebody. So like I have my entire library shared with my wife's Google account. And it was pretty cool because in Google Photos on her phone, she was able to go like see my account, like see my photos. But she was also able to say, hey, like copy all these. Anytime Bradley uploads a new photo, like copy all those to my library. You can even say from this day forward, and you can also do it with just certain faces as well. So it's, yeah, and that's, I'm hopeful iCloud will rig something like that up in the future, because there right now there's not a way for my wife to see our iCloud photo library from one of her devices. Ideally, I'd love to see a way for her to, like, you know, kind of the same thing as Google, like, let me share my entire thing with her. She can copy what she wants to, but the biggest thing is just her being able to see it. Like, if she wants to see the library, for me to be able to see her library and copy things to mine.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the next kind of frontier, I think, for iCloud photo sharing is being able to do something with it within the family structure as well. I think that's going to be powerful. Because other things do it, like calendars do it as well. You know, Find My Friends does it. Why not photos?
Yeah, the hooks are there. I mean, obviously, you could do a shared family album, and that's auto-created with when you set up family sharing. But that's like, again, you have to post things to it, and they're not full size. So that's my latest photo adventure. So that was a good trip, though, but good to be home. Thankfully, nothing blew up on the network while I was gone, and that's always nice. And Chris, it's like we were talking about that. So I even said, like, well, if it does, there's like not much I can do because I'm a long way away.
Yeah, you're gonna have to. On spotty internet, it's going to be hard to recover very much. But apart from the fact that, you know, all the networks in the world broke while you were gone, that's something we'll talk about in a little minute. But it's been an interesting time for Wi-Fi.
Yes, it has. Big week. So let's wrap up your new network rollout. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we finished up the last show. You were just kind of talking about the deployment, and then now it's done. So where are we at?
Yeah, I think the day after we recorded the last show, I was we did a bunch of work in the building to just during the course of one school day just install all the access points and cut new drop cables for wherever they needed to go. Apart from one or two places where we had to go into the crawl space to put a cable in, those are in now as well. But during that the day after we last recorded, it was a day before the last day of term, so it was a Thursday before the Friday that we're going to finish for the holidays. we got all the hardware put in place, and then in the evening I went back in and I was going to try and just connect up a few bits and pieces to try and get a signal going so I could make sure everything was good. And it basically ended up being quicker just to set everything up because all the cables were in place, and it was just a matter of basically wiring up the switch in the cupboard and then going around the classroom and plugging in the new access point where the old access point had been. So I did that, and the network came up and it ran, and we ran for the whole first day, or the last day of term, but the first day of the new network, with basically no issues, apart from having to tell the staff a new Wi-Fi password. The students, all their iPads had configuration profiles on them with the new password for the new Wi-Fi network on it already. So they automatically migrated over. I literally didn't touch any student iPad at all, and they all came up in the new network perfectly. That seems to have been great so far. There's a few bits and pieces of worth that I wanted to tweak, you know, things like DNS server settings and different stuff like that, and a few firewall rules to put in place. But in general, the first day went really well, and most people didn't notice, which was great. And a few classrooms where there had been some really bad signal problems or lack of coverage or whatever were significantly better. So nice improvement overall, as far as I can see.
Yeah, that's great. It's always, you just want to get those like first few days of a new network done, without any weirdness.
Yeah, no. In between times, on that first day, I mostly relied on the access points choosing their channels automatically. But since that time, I've gone around and I've had a look at the channels, and I've actually manually set all the channels for the access points, and that has gone reasonably well. I got a little bit confused, though, and this might be helpful for anybody who is new to Ubiquiti stuff, is that by default, the 5 gigahertz radio uses a 40 megahertz wide channel, and the names of the 40 megahertz channels are different from the names for the 20 megahertz channel. So I was really confused, because the way you set up in the interface is you choose the width of your channel, and then you choose the channel that you want to be on. And the pop-up menu where you choose the channel number, it shows the numbers for the 20 megahertz channels, but in 802.11ac, the 40 megahertz channels are named differently. So if I can sort of explain it this way, that a 40 megahertz channel is basically two channels combined together. So if you have channel 36 and channel 40 combined together, the name of that channel is called 38, i.e. it's halfway between 36 and 40, right? But the problem is that the UniFi user interface shows the names of the 20 megahertz channels. So it looks like you choose channel 36, and then the access point ends up being on channel 38, and you're like, why did it change numbers? And eventually I figured out it was because I was using 40 megahertz wide channels. So that took me a bit head scratching to figure out why the numbers kept changing from what I set in the interface, but that was the explanation for it. So go over that, fixed it.
Yeah. The megahertz on AC is a kind of a, it's just not, it's not a game, but like there's trade-offs. So
yeah,
the higher you can go to 20 megahertz, 40 megahertz, or even 80 megahertz. And obviously 80 megahertz is like really, really fast. But then your channel width is much wider. And so, again, there's no right answer. It just depends on, like, obviously the wider your channel is you can support, like the faster it'll go, which is better. But like the thing is, like 20 megahertz for an iPad is probably going to be enough, and it does open up additional channel capacity, but again, it's going to be slower. Like if you do just a raw speed test, it's going to be slower than 40 megahertz.
Yeah, there is a trade-off there, and you've got to look at, I suppose it really comes down to your requirements for density, doesn't it? You know, if you're trying to put multiple access points, say you're fitting out, I don't know, a gymnasium where you're putting maybe 10 access points in a huge place, or maybe more, you'd want to have the narrower channels so you could have more channels. Whereas in my situation, I'm putting in between 1 and 2 access points in most rooms, so I don't need multiple channels on that short range radio, so I decided to go for 40. That was actually the default, and I just left it that way. But I've been experimenting with 80 megahertz channels at home, and I don't think iPads can tell a difference, to be honest with you. So I think we'll stick with 40 for now.
The home is where you can pull 80 off. I don't think in the enterprise most people can pull it off. And you just don't need it. Like the risk isn't worth the reward, other than being able to like speed test it or screenshot a speed test. Like that's literally the only reason. Overall, solid rollout, and everyone's happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to have gone really, really well. Yeah.
Before we move on, let's thank our sponsor for tonight. It's the great folks at Jamf. Now, Jamf Pro is our preferred solution for deploying, managing, and securing your Apple devices. Over 3 million students, including my students and Fraser students, are powered by Jamf every single day. Bring learning to a whole new level for your students by providing the tools they need to be successful in today's classrooms. Start a free trial of Jamf at J-A-M-F. That's Jamf.com. Thanks to Jamf for sponsoring Out of School this week. So what we kind of want to talk about as our somewhat main topic was the crack attacks with a K. And this kind of broke late Sunday night, and I saw it on Ars Technica late Sunday night, and I thought, all right, this is going to be fun. And it was really on Monday we all came to work, and I guess everybody, there was just a lot of information coming out quickly. So Fraser, do you want to summarize from a 40,000-foot perspective what the crack attack is?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of wild speculation in the press. Not speculation, but reasonably informed fact, but not all that realistic from an operational point of view, discussion about what this problem is. And basically what it is that a researcher, a PhD student in Belgium, discovered that there was a flaw in the design of the WPA2 encryption protocol that is used on basically all Wi-Fi networks. And the problem is that it's a flaw in the protocol. It's not a flaw in any implementation. And this is where some people, I thought, were getting a little bit confused, because it's not that Apple or Google or Cisco or Aerohive or anybody has to have made a mistake for their client to be vulnerable. If their implementation is completely correct according to the spec, this is still a problem, because the problem's in the spec. It's not in any one implementation. So what it is as part of WPA2 encryption, what happens is that the access point and the client both have to prove to each other that they know the password for the Wi-Fi, right? So the password you put in is not the encryption key that is used to transmit data, but the client has to prove to the access point that it's got the password, but the access point also has to prove to the client so that the client knows that it's not talking with a rogue or a fake access point. So there's a process in the protocol called a four-way handshake, and what happens is that both sides use that password to encrypt a message to each other, and then if they can both decrypt the message correctly, then they know that the other person's got the right key. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's a kind of mutual authentication system without actually sharing the secret either way, because if you share the secret, you don't know that the other end is actually legitimate just yet. So basically what happens with the crack vulnerability is that there is a way that if you can fake an access point and force a client to go onto that access point, you can make the client reuse certain parts of that handshake and force what's called a key reinstallation attack, which means that you basically put an old key back in, or a known key, so that the malicious access point that you've created can then intercept and decrypt packets from the client, basically. So what happens is somebody does essentially a classic man-in-the-middle attack, where they set up a system in between your client and what you think is the real system, and they can look at private information. So there's a YouTube video by the researcher on this, and it shows them using their technique plus a tool called SSL strip to force a secure website down to insecure HTTP, and then they use the Wireshark protocol analyzer to extract the username and password logging in on a website. So that's the high level view of the crack vulnerability, and as you can probably tell from what I've already said, it's not a trivial attack to do, but it is a widespread flaw. So there's a wide footprint for the problem, but the impact in your school network is probably not as great as you might be led to believe based on what you might have read in the press.
Well, and so I would imagine a lot of major enterprises, like the CIOs, were calling the Wi-Fi admin in today or that day. So yeah. What are we going to do? And that's the natural reaction. But the reality is there's no known code in the wild for using this flaw. And on top of that, you have to be on site with sophisticated equipment to be able to do this. So like, it's not like you can do it from your basement to a bank or somewhere else, or like a coffee shop across the world. And so again, yeah, very, very serious problem in nature, but not so much in like practicality for today. Which in reality is a good problem to have because it's so widespread and it's got so much attention. Everyone is moving very, very quickly to get this fixed. I've not seen so many people working on so one thing or focusing on such one thing in the enterprise market in quite a while. Now, this doesn't like require WPA3. It's not like the going from like when the WEP, wireless, I think it's wireless equivalency protection, was basically cracked and like it was just useless at that point. Like WPA2 is still solid. This can be fixed and it can be patched and it's fine. It's just, you know, and again, this is mainly on the client side. Now, I think there's like 9 10 vulnerabilities, or maybe I think there's 9 vulnerabilities have been discovered as a result of this. I mean, he discovered this information like earlier this year, and they just kind of spent time, I think, working with manufacturers and helping everyone get ready. But all but one of them, I think, I mean, the majority of these have to be patched by the client, can they not?
Yeah, you're right. There's only one vulnerability that's actually specifically to do with the or that can be fixed on the access point. And primarily that, I think it involves when an access point is acting as a client, like if you've got a mesh network, you know, so one access point is talking to the other as if it was a client. That's one vulnerability. And of course, I was looking at this for Ubiquiti this week, and they're saying, okay, we've got this patch for our access points, but that only solves 1 out of 9 of these problems. The rest of them are the problem. You got to get an iOS update or a macOS update or a Windows update or something in order to make sure you're fully protected.
Yeah, I mean, that was the rush Monday morning, was like asking all the Wi-Fi vendors, hey, where are your patches? Where are your patches? And again, most of them, Meraki has a patch out, Aruba has a patch out, Cisco, Ubiquiti, and Arrow all have patches out. And I believe Ruckus is working on it. I mean, everyone's working on this, but the rush was to like go to your Wi-Fi vendor and ask for a patch. And it's like, well, that's like all your doors being unlocked and you have like a side window in the bathroom that has a slight crack in it, sort of thing. And you're focused on the window. Like the clients are still the issue, 100% here. So for Apple products, which is like the majority of our users, all current in the wild versions of iOS are vulnerable. It is patched in iOS as of 11.1, which is like, I know public beta 3 is out, and so that should be rolling out very, very soon. And then macOS is coming in the next release as well. Again, there are no known patches, so this is probably fine that it's taking them a few days. It would be ideal that it would be out, but you know, it's not like Apple is caught flat-footed here.
Yeah, I think there's a certain window where it's going to be okay. But I think the risk with all these things always is that the risk exposure changes over time, and we're going to talk about a little bit about vulnerability scoring in a minute. But as a vulnerability becomes more widely known and widely understood, hackers and even white hat hackers will develop tools to exploit it much more easily. So while it might be a very difficult and sophisticated attack today, in 6 months' time, there's going to be a rootkit you can download or a tool set you can download in order to just run this attack. So after a while, it's going to be pretty critical. And I think this is something that we have to think about in terms of, you know, there's a lot of schools where they might be running iPad 2 or something like that, where those devices are not getting new security updates. I mean, I know even in my own house, we've got iPad mini 1s kicking about, which are stuck in iOS 9. And there's not going to be a patch for iOS 9, I'm pretty sure about that. So question, what do we do about that? You know, are we going to have to throw them away and get new ones? Depends on your security posture. It also depends on what you do with them. I mean, for us, those devices are basically just Netflix clients, so I don't really care. There's not really personal data on those things. But if it was a more enterprise situation or a school situation, I would be a little more concerned if I was running devices that were out of software support.
Well, and my big concern here is not, like you said, not the older Apple devices. My big concern is gear is like Internet of Things gear, you know, and I'm not even so much worried about like in your home. That's, I mean, obviously like whatever. I mean, there are probably things people, I mean, my in-laws, like they live out in the woods. And so like, it's like an open network. I mean, you know, like there's, they leave their doors unlocked half the time sort of thing. But it's like any internal IoT gear in your office, that's using Wi-Fi. I mean, will, and it's not, with a lot of this IoT gear, it's not a question of like when it will be updated, but it's if it'll be updated and if there's even a mechanism for the thing to be updated.
Yeah, every Wemo switch you've got in your place and every, I mean, I'm thinking in my house, you know, I've got the Wi-Fi central heating controller. Is that going to get an update? Well, I know the answer to that, which is no, right? Most of these things are not going to get updated. So it's a concern, right? It really is.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, going past, so we covered the Wi-Fi vendors, we covered Apple, have we covered anybody else?
Google, what are Google doing with that? There's what did I read today? In the coming weeks, they said there's going to be a patch for Chrome OS. There are patches in the latest security update for Android devices. If you get Google security updates on your device, which is not that many devices, to be honest with you. So Nexus and Pixel devices will get an update. Some of the newer Samsung stuff will get an update. But then there's going to be billions of Android devices that will never see an update. So again, that's probably the biggest concern actually worldwide, is all these Android handsets that will never see a security update. And people are actually genuinely putting personal data through them and not just using it for Netflix. So that would be a big concern for me. Microsoft have patched Windows. Amazon are still evaluating all their stuff.
Windows Phone was patched as well, even though it's end of life, it was patched.
Yeah, yep. And the Wi-Fi vendors are hot on this, of course, because the focus is kind of like, well, Wi-Fi is broken, so the Wi-Fi people have to be seen to be doing a lot. But like we said, a lot of the responsibility for this comes down to the client vendors and making sure that your iOS and your macOS are up to date.
Yeah, and you know, again, we talk about Android versus like old iPads. Like, we're not talking about like old Android phones. We're talking about like the millions of Android phones that are sold that are just, you know, that aren't running Google Play services, that are like are very, very cheap. I mean, you just, those things don't, just because they're running Android doesn't mean they're getting Google's security updates. And so it certainly, if you're looking at things overseas, you know, again, you know, manufacturers that are using the base of Android but nothing else, that could be the concern.
Yeah, very definitely, very definitely. So I suppose in terms of steps to take, Bradley, you know, what are we going to do about this? Well, obviously, I think this is one of these situations, you know, there's been a lot of updates to iOS 11, three minor releases since it came out. I haven't pushed hard to get a lot of those updated in our school because most of them relate to fixes for the iPhone 8 and things like that. But I think whenever the update that fixes this problem comes out, it's going to be one of these situations where you stop the bus until everybody gets an update, and I'm going to have to just take some time and make sure that all my devices are updated. Now, you can do this quite easily using Jamf Pro, right? What I do is I make a smart group and I set the version to be the very latest version of iOS. And then I have another smart group, which is anything less than that version. So I can see, I've got two lists, one of who's on the latest version and who's not on the latest version. And then that just becomes my kind of hit list, if you like, and I just go into school and I find these people. Some of them I have them in my class. I can just say, right, you know, everybody take 10 minutes to start the class. We're going to do a software update. Other people I don't teach, I've got to go and find them and say, look, in front of me right now, press this button so I know that you're updated. And that's just the way I deal with that. You know, it's not super easy, but you can maybe think of other ways that you could force people to do certain things as well. Another trick is forcibly setting the wallpaper on iPads that don't have the latest software update. You can say, you know, update your iPad very soon. Or another good trick is pushing out a home screen configuration profile that blocks all the apps. And then people come to your door and go, where have all my apps gone? And you say, well, it's because you've not updated iOS. So those are some techniques for forcing people to pay attention to what you're trying to do on their device.
Yeah, then obviously with your Wi-Fi gear, definitely push that out as soon as you can, you know, the updated firmware. In your switching or network equipment, it's not vulnerable. This is specifically with Wi-Fi. So unless you have like a wireless switch, which I don't think anybody would have that, you're fine there. So, yeah. And then obviously same thing with macOS, push it out via, JSS or, you can just go around and like tell people to, hey, we don't need to update. This is a good time to get everybody on High Sierra. Now, one thing this is going to force people onto APFS if they have a MacBook Air or any of the other flash storage drives. So that upgrade takes a little bit longer. But again, no time like the present.
I would not be surprised if we saw a backported fix for Sierra on this one as well, and possibly the one before iOS. I don't think is going to get that, but I think there's a possibility that you might see security fixes for older versions of macOS.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it'd be Sierra and El Capitan.
Yeah, I couldn't remember the name of the one before Sierra. That's how my brain goes these days.
They all start running together.
Yeah.
I had a machine brought to me, or not too long ago, someone said, hey, can we get this updated to the latest Mac software? And it was like a personal machine, and looked at it, it was running Snow Leopard. I'm like, no, I don't.
Wait.
It was like the pre-App Store one. I'm like, no, there's not much we can do here.
Yeah, that's gone for sure. So yeah, and I suppose the other thing to do is if you do have, like, you know, heaven forbid, a BYOD situation or even just a staff BYOD situation where you let people have access to systems from personal devices, you're going to want to make sure that you've not got a vulnerability in there that you don't know about. You know, if you have somebody's got an unpatched Android phone, are they able to connect to your MIS system? Depends. So it's just something. It's part of the job, I suppose, but it's something to think about is what do you have in your suite and what can you do to get it sorted?
Yeah, and everybody's risk here is going to be, it would depend on what kind of industry you're in. It's something that needs to be fixed, but it's not like, it's not like you need to like go around everybody and force them to update that morning. It's like, that's something you do need to get to very soon. But, you know, if you're a school, for example, I'm not super, super worried about it just yet.
Yeah, no. And I think it very much depends on the emerging environment to do with what kind of tools become available. Cause like we said, it's a tricky exploit right now, but it might not be a tricky exploit in 6 months time.
Yeah. So, anything else we want to cover with Crack?
Well, I thought leading on from Crack, we could have a little talk, Bradley, about a thing called the Common Vulnerability Scoring Scheme, or CVSS, which was something that I found quite interesting when I was digging into, like, how bad is this problem? There's actually a system for deciding how bad a security problem is and how quickly you have to respond to it. And I thought we might have a wee chat about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, basically, CVSS is a method of ranking the severity of security problems in computer systems. So you may have a problem that is extremely difficult to do. You need to have special permissions. You need to trick the user into doing something. And you need to have your hands on a device. And you need to be in the room where it happens. And if you have that kind of problem, that's not a serious exploit, because the chances of it actually being run against you can be quite slim. Whereas if you have something like, I'm trying to think of a particular problem, but you remember the Heartbleed bug, for example, in OpenSSL, that was something that could be executed from across the internet and would cause a web server to disclose some extra information that it shouldn't be disclosing. Sometimes that could be quite critical information. So that's a much more serious exploit because people can run it from anywhere. Whereas Crack, for example, is something that you have to be what's called on an adjacent network, basically on the same Wi-Fi network or within Wi-Fi range, to get that up and running. So CVSS kind of ranks these in terms of severity, and it's quite a useful system to know a little bit about. So the way that this score kind of is arrived at, Bradley, is that there's a thing called a base score, which is made up of two parts. One is a metric for how exploitable is this problem, like how easy is it to run the attack. And the second part of that is how serious is the impact if the attack is successful. So you put those two things together, you add them together, and you get a score out of 10, right? So it's their decimal score. So Crack, for example, is rated 6.8 out of 10. So it's considered a medium exploit. It's not a critical exploit, which would be 9 and above, or a serious exploit, which I think is, from memory, 7, 8, and 9. It's kind of medium in that sense. And then you also have things called temporal metrics and environmental metrics, which are things to do with, like I mentioned, you know, the situation changes over time. So today, there might not be an exploit toolkit for crack. So the temporal metric might be quite low right now, but it might rise in the future if there's somebody publishes tools to do it trivially. So the exploit can become more serious in the future because it becomes easier to do, basically. And the environmental metrics are things to do with how serious is it in your personal environment. And that's kind of comes back to the question that we mentioned there, Bradley, about how how critical is the information that this device deals with, right? So, for example, in my situation where the vulnerable device is a Netflix tool, the environmental metric would probably tend to suggest that the risk is low because I don't care about, Netflix data being stolen, but I might care much more if it was a device that I used to access personal information in the school, for example. With me so far? Cool. So, basically, I just thought we would maybe talk a little bit about how we get that base metric, because that's the one that really sets the scene for how serious a situation is. And there's two parts to that, as I said. There's the exploitability metric, and then there's the impact metric. So we could do a little quiz here, Bradley, if you like, right? I'm going to ask you some questions, and you're going to tell me the answer for crack. Can we do it that way?
Yes.
Okay, so let's look at exploitability first. The first question is, how does the attack happen, or what's known as the attack vector? Is it an exploit that can be done from across the internet? Is it an exploit that needs to happen on the local network, or do you have to have local access to the component that you're going to work on, or do you actually have to have it in your hands, right? So network, adjacent, local, or physical. Which one is crack?
It's adjacent,
yeah, that's right, because you have to be within Wi-Fi range to attack a client. You can't do a crack attack from Russia, for example, to choose a country at random. That's part number one, okay? Part number two is attack complexity. How hard is the exploit to do? And there's two options here, right? It's either low or it's high. And the definition of low is that no specialized conditions are required in order to run the attack. If it's high, then some specialized conditions, preparation, or knowledge are required to carry out the attack. Which one is crack?
Crack, I would say, is high.
It's high, right? Because you have to do some preparation. You have to get in the right condition. You have to be close enough to a device. And some of these things are outside the attacker's control. Imagine there was a bug in iOS where if you typed in 0000 into the PIN code screen, it would unlock any phone in the world. That would be a low complexity attack because it would always work. Whereas the crack attack is a high complexity attack because sometimes you may not have the conditions you need to pull off the attack correctly. So we know that the attack vector is adjacent, the attack complexity is high. The next question is how many privileges are required, or what level of privileges are required to run this attack? It can either be none, no privileges are required, low, where regular user privileges will be enough, or high, in that you have to have administrator privileges. Where would you place crack in this list?
I'm going to place crack at low.
Okay. It's actually lower than that. It's none. Well, it's actually worse than that. Right? That crack is a no privileges required, because all you have to do is you have to get within radio range of the client, and then the conditions have to be right to run the attack. But you don't need to know the user's PIN code for their device to make them do it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah. So in sense of seriousness, that's actually worse, right? Because if you needed to know a root password, for example, that would be a harder attack to do. But because crack is an unprivileged attack, that's actually more serious than if it was a privileged attack. Then the last one is user interaction. Do you need to trick the user into doing something in order for your attack to work? You can think of many ways in which you would have an attack where, maybe you have to trick somebody into installing a piece of software or putting in their password into a website that wasn't the same website. Those require user interaction, but crack, as you probably guessed, is a no interaction attack, because all you have to do is be within radio range. So when we look at exploitability, we have, it's an adjacent attack, it's high complexity, It requires no privileges, and it doesn't require user interaction. So that puts it as in the sort of category of relatively low exploitability, right? The actual number, if I look at my notes here, the overall exploitability score for crack is just 1.6. Okay, so that puts it relatively low down the risk list. Okay, but the problem is that the impact is so high that it actually becomes a medium attack. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about impact. Okay, there's really three areas of impact. One is confidentiality, one is integrity, and one is availability, right? So any attack could compromise any or all of three of those things. So a high impact confidentiality attack would be one where there's a total loss of confidentiality. There is a low level as well where some restricted information is obtained, but the attacker can't choose what information they get, or there can be no impact in that. Okay, so you can probably guess where crack shows up in that list.
Definitely high.
It's high, right? Because every single thing can, if you can force the key to be something you know, then you can decrypt every packet on the network. Yeah. The same thing is true for integrity. You know, can the attacker compromise it? The attacker can compromise any packet because you're doing a man-in-the-middle attack. So the example in the video for crack attack was they showed an Android client going onto an HTTPS website, and then the attacker forced it from HTTPS down to HTTP and then used Wireshark to read off the username and password that was being logged in with. So obviously there's a high impact on integrity as well. Crack doesn't have any impact on availability. So there's no denial of service here. There's not even a degradation of service. It's just you're just reading all the information. So there's no impact on availability, but there's high impact on integrity and confidentiality. So overall, crack's impact score is 5.2. So it's medium impact, but it's low exploitability. So can you see how that helps us to think about in school, Bradley, what the problem might be? Or how serious it might be, or how likely we might be to suffer this attack at any particular point?
Well, yeah, I mean, because there's a lot of things, for example, that could happen to, say, our website. But if you ran, like, your web server through this, where are you at on that? I mean, the vulnerability always exists, but what's the likelihood of it?
Yeah. I mean, your school could go on fire, right? But what's the impact of your school going on fire? How vulnerable are you to going on fire? There's some similar questions, I think, for computer security. So, you know, you're dealing with up to, what, grade 5 in your school? And this is a very difficult to exploit attack. Are you actually at risk of your students running this attack against your school today?
Well, I mean, technically, yes.
Technically, yes. But in reality, given how hard it is to run that attack, is a 6-year-old going to be able to achieve this?
No.
No. If somebody did, right, if you were being targeted by a black hat hacker with a lot of resources, then yes, you probably have quite a serious problem. But if you're being attacked by black hat hackers right now, you've got a bigger problem than just this particular exploit. So that's what gives me a little bit of comfort in this respect, is that the exploitability score is so low here, but the impact score is high. So we're not taking it lightly, but we're not... It's not a case of I've got to shut down the network until it's fixed either.
You know what I mean? Well, and honestly, if you've got a student that could do this, they need to go work somewhere.
Yeah, they get an automatic pass if they can do that. But it is a different situation for me, Bradley, right? Because I've got 16, 17, 18-year-olds in my network whose intentions might not always be absolutely pure. So that is something to be aware of, right? And if you do have, and you probably will know of people in your school, if you're running a high school or something, who are extremely technically sophisticated and have a lot of time on their hands and probably some good resources as well, you might consider that to be more of a serious threat than you might think. So this is where the art comes in, right? The science is, you know, what's the attack vector, blah, blah, blah. But then you got to decide, what's my number here, right? What's the number that I'm comfortable with, and what's the number beyond which I've got to do something quite serious about it very quickly?
Yeah. I mean, again, this is a serious problem, but I guarantee you have more physical security problems that are more pressing today than the crack attacks are to your network.
Yeah. Although, having said that, one of the things, particularly in the UK with data protection, is like say you were to leave your crack attack vulnerable machines running for, say, 2 years from now, and you suffered a data breach through that vector, that would not go down very well with the authorities. Do you see what I mean? So it's not something that can be left or ignored. It's something that you have to know in relatively short order that you have closed this particular hole. But it's not like unplug the network until it's fixed. It's not that bad, but it's not simple either.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, if someone asked me about it internally and no one has, I would say, yeah, we'll be pushing out updates as soon as we have them available, but I'm not stressing about it right now. I'm trying to think of, a good example. It's kind of like the Y2K bug. Like, you want to get it fixed, but it's not imperative like you have it done right today.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at the way that client owners like Apple and Google and Microsoft are dealing with this, they're saying we're going to have fixes within a couple of weeks. You know, they're not saying we have a fix tomorrow or we're putting out an emergency patch or anything like that. They're saying in due course, we will fix this bug, but we're not stopping the presses to fix it right away. And I think for now, that's pretty reasonable. And until something happens where, you know, if there's a widely publicized set of scripts that, you know, can trivially exploit this problem, that might change the scenario. But right now, I think the response has been pretty good overall. I don't think there's any serious player who's really got a problem right now.
Yeah, the thing I hated was like, and that's it with anything, it's like all the misinformation around it. It's like half truths around it is the only thing I don't like. But that's just going to happen.
Well, it's a technical and complicated thing, you know, and I suppose the problem for people like us is that our bosses and our directors and so on will come in and say, oh, I read about this thing when, you know, all Wi-Fi worldwide is broken. What are we doing about it? You know, and you have to, I think it's helpful to have some of the technical knowledge to say, well, here's what's actually at risk. Here's how we're going to fix it. Here's how soon I expect the fix to happen. And here's the risk in the risk profile in the meantime, which is elevated, but not through the roof, I would say.
Right.
So I'm relatively relaxed about it as well. I'm going to get fixes in a couple of weeks' time. I'm going to push hard on those fixes, but I'm not unplugging the network until it is fixed. That wouldn't be the right approach either.
Yeah. So we'll have links to some of this information in the show notes. You know, about the common vulnerability scoring system. We'll have links to some of the things you talked about in the show, and some additional links about crack. Particularly, like, if you have a boss asking you for more information, it's good. Some good articles, and I've kind of read a couple over the week that have been very, very accurate and very, very, like, normalized, like, where it's not heavy on the technical. Because I think most of us freaked out, like, Wi-Fi security is broken, and it's true and it's not true at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, you read that headline, you've got to find out how broken is it. But once you read it, you sort of like, well, okay, technically it's broken, but it'll be fixed as well. You know, it's not a case that you have to go out and buy new Wi-Fi hardware or anything like that. It's just software updates.
Right. So thanks for listening to the show this week. I will have links in the show notes at outofschool.net. If you'd like to sponsor the show, we have a link on there where you can send some information. We'd love to talk to you about how you can talk to get in front of our listeners and talk about your products and services. I am on Twitter at Bradley Chambers, and my blog is chambersdaily.com.
Okay, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web, where I just published a write-up of our Ubiquity deployment as well, so you might be interested in
that. And our next show is going to be fun because it's not going to be a fun topic, but I think it'll be an interesting topic because we're going to be talking, I'm going to be talking with someone about disaster prep and disaster recovery from someone that went through one of the hurricanes here in the southern U.S. So I think the part I'm most interested in is the preparation. When you know something's coming, what do you do? So it'll be fun. So look for that on our next episode. And again, if you use Apple Podcasts, we'd appreciate you leaving a review. If you use the Overcast, we'd appreciate you hitting the star button to recommend this to other people as well. And hope everybody has a great rest of their week.